Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. This week, we are presenting a special series of speakers from the 2017 Camden Conference. Now in its 30th year, the Camden Conference convenes annually to bring together a variety of diplomats, professors, journalists, and policy officials to address a topic of international, political, and humanitarian significance. The 2017 Camden Conference, Refugees and Global Migration, Humanity's Crisis, features speakers exploring the varied causes of the current international migration crisis and the challenges that come with accepting immigrants from particular countries, regions, and demographic groups. We will be featuring two of the conference speakers today. Today's first speaker is Kaas Mudde, associate professor in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and researcher at the Center for Research on Extremism at the University of Oslo. His research focuses on extremism and democracy, and it's guided by the question, how can liberal democracies defend themselves without undermining their core values? The subject of his talk today is, has the refugee crisis created a perfect storm for the far right?
What I'm going to focus on today is to make the connection between the refugee crisis and the rise of the radical right. And before I do that, I will first talk a little bit about the history, because here in the US, with the rise of Trump, the media have discovered the topic of the radical right and think that it all started here, but it didn't. And actually, even here, it didn't start with Trump. So post-war Europe was very much defined by the Second World War and by the Holocaust. And so after the Second World War, every initiative pretty much for decades was set up with in mind, never forget, never again. And pretty much the whole moral order was around the evil was fascism. And as a consequence, depending on the country, from countries like Germany and the Netherlands, where even the mildest form of nationalism was perceived as just the first step to Auschwitz, to countries like Italy, where they made a convenient distinction between Italian fascism and German national socialism. But overall, the idea was this should never happen again. And logically, radical right parties, particularly fascist parties, had a hard time getting back in shape. And so we had a small wave in the first 10 years after the war of so-called post-fascism, which was really just some old hands of the fascist parties of the Second World War, only really in Italy and Germany. And then in the 1950s, 60s, we had a second wave of right-wing populism, which was a very diverse group from farmers, primarily in the Netherlands and France, to anti-tax, anti-welfare kind of populist parties in Scandinavia. Again, very weak, not much success. And it really only started in the 1980s with what is called the third wave of the radical right. Now, this third wave was linked to mass immigration and to political resentment. Just some dates and numbers so that you understand that the radical right in Europe predates not just the refugee crisis, it predates the Great Recession as well. It's not just a function of crisis. It's more structural. So the Front National in France won 14.9% of the vote in 1997. Now, just in case you don't know that, most European countries have proportional representation, which means that a good score is something like 25%. Like, often the biggest party in a country is about one third of the vote. So if you have about 15% of the vote, you will be the third biggest party. You will matter, generally. The FPÖ, the Austrian Freedom Party, won 27% of the vote in 1999, actually entered the government in 2000. The Swiss People's Party won 26.6% of the vote. Has actually been the biggest party in Switzerland for many years now. Overall, in Western Europe, radical right parties gained about 1.7% in the 1980s to about 4.8% in the 1990s and about 5.9% in the first decade of this century. Today, it would probably be around 10, 12%. Now, that doesn't sound that much, but it's all very uneven. And so there are roughly a third of countries where there is no radical right to speak of. And then there are certain countries where the radical right will be the biggest party, will get a third of the vote or even more. The refugee crisis has created a perfect storm for the radical right. And so the radical right, the populist radical right, combines three different features, ideological features: nativism, authoritarianism, and populism. Nativism is the idea that a state, a political unit, should be congruent with a nation, a cultural unit. What it by and large argues is that every nation should have its own state, every state should have its own nation, should be monocultural. Nativism also perceives anything that is non-native or alien as threatening. Now, that is not only individuals, it's not just people, it can also be ideas or even languages. So for example, many nativist parties in Europe are very worried about Americanization, which they see as things like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, but also the use of English language. Right? So nativism is a bit broader than just being worried about individuals, but obviously immigration is at the heart of the issues for nativists. And the refugee crisis led to this belief that aliens were overrunning or swamping the country. Newspaper after newspaper would use these terms, feeding into it, and then you would have pictures as the one above, which are actually refugees walking from Budapest to Austria. And it also means the refugee crisis was meant as countries cannot protect its own borders. Right? What the refugee crisis showed was that we can't stop them, which is, of course, ultimately threatening for nativists who want to make sure that only those come in that they like. And then, absolutely crucial to any type of immigration debate in Europe, but also now the refugees, the majority of those that came were Muslim, or at least from Muslim-majority countries. And after 9/11, like the whole role of Islam and of Muslims in Western societies was already a hot debate. And so the refugee crisis triggered the nativism, but it also triggered the debate about immigration and about integration, both issues which are prime issues for the radical right. Now, authoritarianism doesn't mean an undemocratic idea. It more is the idea that the state should enforce order very strictly through law and order policies, tight policing, high sentences, as well as enforcement of discipline. Obviously, one of the key issues, political issues, that triggers authoritarianism is crime. And the refugee crisis was from the beginning linked to crime. On top of that, it links nativism and crime, right? Because it's crime by refugees, by foreigners. And the worst, and that's always very good for newspapers as well as for triggering all kind of prejudices, is when you can link it to sexual crime, right? And so in 2016, New Year's Eve, there was a big mass of people, mostly from North Africa, who were celebrating New Year's Eve in Cologne, one of the major cities in Germany, around the railway station. And there was a very high number of pickpocketing, but also sexual assaults, that led to these type of headlines, which obviously are also racist. But the Süddeutsche Zeitung is actually one of the best liberal newspapers, right? So if you get these type of headlines on those newspapers, you can only imagine what the tabloids will present. The refugee crisis also coincided with an increase in terrorism. Like 2015 started with the terrorist attack on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris. There was a massive attack in Brussels. There was, at the end, the massive attack in Paris. From the beginning, the two were linked. Not just by the media, actually individual politicians. On the night of the second terrorist attack in November, both the Prime Minister of Bavaria, the most powerful state of Germany, as well as the Foreign Minister of Poland, were already tweeting that this terrorist attack showed that we should close the border because refugees were terrorists. Right? Those are not even the radical right, the usual radical right ones. And so this whole discourse, right, of refugees and crime plays straight into the hands of the radical right. Now, the last point is populism. And populism is an idea that society is distinguished between two homogeneous and antagonistic groups. You have the pure people on the one hand and the corrupt elite on the other. And you believe that politics should follow what is called the general will of the people. So you think that policies can be made that benefit everyone in the same way. And you believe pretty much that the reason why we don't have these policies is because there is a corrupt elite on top that holds that back. Now, it's important that it's an elite, not elites. So the argument is that it doesn't matter whether it's Democrat or Republican, they're both corrupt. And although they say that they're different, they're really working together against the will of the people. Now, where populism was triggered was that the whole issue of nativism and authoritarianism, the refugee crisis was linked to borders. And within the European Union, there are no internal borders in the so-called Schengen zone. The argument, as a consequence, is as soon as someone is in Greece, or more specifically, in Hungary, they can be in Sweden, they can be in the Netherlands, right? And so that goes, first of all, to the nativism, like we can't protect our borders, but then the question is, why? And so everyone was angry at the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who was one of the few, and of course, one of the loudest voices for so-called Willkommenskultur, or welcome politics, a welcome culture. And she had said, all refugees are welcome. Now, many others said, well, that's fine that you think so, but if you make them welcome to Germany, they can go also to my country. And we might not actually want them. And so this interdependence of the European Union was really felt. The refugee crisis let that out. If the Dutch don't want to have refugees, but Germany does, it means that you have a large number of refugees at your border, which you actually can't protect anymore. Right? I don't know whether the number has been named before, but roughly in 2015, 1.5 million refugees came in to Europe. About 850,000 came to Germany alone. Right? And so what Germany does is always very important, but if you have 850,000 refugees in Germany, all the countries around it are affected. Now, the argument of the radical right is the reason why we don't protect our borders is because we're all trying to please the EU. And our national politicians don't stand up for our country and our nation. Rather, they're chummy with their other elite friends in Europe, in Brussels, right, protecting their own kind of interests. So nativism, authoritarianism, populism were all triggered by the refugee crisis. Now, what is the political fallout of this all? There are three major consequences. First, there has been a surge in the popular support of far-right parties. Pretty much all of the parties that were already reasonably established would do better. Interestingly enough, the refugee crisis hasn't really created new parties. Most of the time, the parties that profited were either established radical right parties like Front National in France, FPÖ in Austria, or Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, who would go from what seemed to have been a ceiling of 15% shot up in the polls to 25, or Marine Le Pen, who went from 20 to 35 in the polls, now lower again. But also what it led to was a far-right turn of right-wing parties. Various parties that were kind of borderline radical right that would play a little bit with anti-immigration topics in elections, but it wasn't core to them, are now emphasizing it over and over again. UK Independence Party in Britain, for example, which used to be just a single issue party wanting to take the UK out of the EU, became a major voice against immigrants and against refugees. Alternative for Germany, similar story. First, more a Eurosceptic party, now a full-blown radical right party. But more importantly, are the developments in Central and Eastern Europe. In particular, this man at the bottom, Viktor Orban. Now, Viktor Orban is the Prime Minister of Hungary, and he has a long career with many fundamental changes. Most importantly, he started out as a kind of libertarian anti-communist dissident. He was the darling of the West. Everyone liked him, got a scholarship from George Soros to go to Oxford, spoke English well. And so when he finally became prime minister at the end of the 1990s, he had moved a bit to the conservative side, but still everyone saw him as the hope, as the new generation of pro-Western, pro-democratic politicians. Once he lost power, didn't work very well. In 2010, he came back into power and transformed Hungary into an illiberal democracy, undermined independence of courts, attacked the media, et cetera, et cetera. Had a new constitution that was deeply nationalist, authoritarian, but he didn't really say much about Europe. He was just busy with his own plan, and he would only lash out against Europe, the European Union, when they criticized him. With the refugee crisis, Orban became a European player. And so he has become the voice of opposition to immigration in general and against multiculturalism. He took on the welcome culture of Angela Merkel and challenged her really for dominance of the European idea. And he has been very successful because what he allowed others to do was actually torpedo Merkel's pro-immigration, but more specifically, pro-refugee plan without standing really in the spotlight. Right? And so the Dutch prime minister, for example, who always supports Merkel on everything, right, is in competition with the radical right party, and so doesn't want to have too many refugees coming. But he can't really speak up about that and be the anti-refugee politician. But Orban can. And then Rutte can say, well, it seems that not everyone is on board with this, so perhaps we should wait. Right? And so Orban has been kind of the shield for more mainstream politicians to defend a much less pro-refugee and increasingly critical of multicultural policies. Now, the real question is this a shock or a transformation? So as I said, the refugee crisis created a perfect storm for the radical right because it brought to the fore their prime issues. Since the refugee crisis, we're not talking anymore about austerity politics. We're not talking anymore about how we can get European integration going again. We're talking about refugees, we're talking about Islam, we're talking about terrorism, we're talking about crime. All of those are the issues of the radical right. That's where they score on. Moreover, we do it within the frame of the radical right. You can talk about refugees in many different ways, but if we all talk about refugees as a potential threat, right, the radical right's already halfway. They don't set that agenda necessarily. Many are not that powerful. This is the frame that is often quite willingly adopted by mainstream media and then jumped on by mainstream politicians. The point is, if these are the major issues in the election, and someone who's really nativist and authoritarian is going to vote, they're not going to vote for the mainstream right party, because they don't trust them to really do the job. They're going to go to the one that has always argued this, right? And so Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is the original leader of the Front National, who's now led by his daughter, already said in the 90s that voters prefer the original over the copy, right? And so when we speak about these issues, by and large, mainstream right-wing parties just help radical right parties win. And this is why the radicalization of right-wing parties is problematic. Because first of all, it pushes policies to the right, pushes discourse to the right, and helps the radical right. What I think is important, though, is that the radicalization of right-wing parties since the refugee crisis is different than before. So obviously, when a new party comes up and has success, established parties are going to respond to that. And most of the time is what they do is that they will adopt some of the discourse. So when the Green parties became successful in the 1980s, everyone started to talk about the environment. We were all very concerned. But we were all very concerned, but we didn't do anything. Right? And that was the same mostly with immigration too and European integration. Everyone talked about it and multiculturalism. Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, David Cameron, they all said that multiculturalism had failed. But they didn't really implement fundamentally different policies. The argument also was it had failed, but we should shape it differently. The goal was still the same, an open society with different people in it. Now, for the first time, we're really talking about, is multiculturalism good? Can Islam be integrated? And that this debate is not just from the radical right. That actually goes deep into the center left. If you look at the Hollande government in France, for example, they speak about Islam more and more negatively. Social Democratic Party in Denmark has campaigned against immigration. So you see an enormous shift. What we saw also, and Trump played a major role in that as well, is we have now a kind of a dominant narrative that politics is all a struggle between the radical right and the status quo. We have various elections coming up in Europe in 2017. They're all framed in exactly the same way. They're all framed as an embattled status quo that is under threat from a resurgence of an incredibly popular radical right. Now, this is to a certain extent the case in the Dutch elections that are next month, where Geert Wilders is currently neck and neck with the prime minister as being the most popular politician. Marine Le Pen is currently the most popular politician in France. But for example, in Germany, the radical right is only 10%. Angela Merkel, who allegedly is incredibly unpopular, if I read the newspapers correctly, is roughly as popular as she was 10 years ago. Now imagine that, a politician who's still equally popular as 10 years ago. Like, most political careers don't last longer than 4 or 5 years. Right? But it doesn't matter, because the frame that we talk about is that frame. And that frame helps the radical right, because it makes the radical right the most important challenger of the status quo. And it makes them a major player, even if they are necessarily not the case. AfD is the fifth biggest party in Germany, for example. But now we talk about the number one against the number five as if they're almost equally powerful. Now, I want to end on a happy note, even though that might be wishful thinking, and maybe I do this more for myself than for you. But I do believe that the success is fragile. Like, we have a narrative today that the populist radical right is really supported and that everyone really trusts them and believes that Trump is fantastic and Marine Le Pen can do everything. It's not. They're exactly the same as other politicians. If they don't deliver, they lose. One of the things in which there can be a Trump effect is not necessarily that it will help the radical right. It does for a while because we talk about the same issues as Trump talks about. But Trump is erratic. And Trump is relatively amateuristic. These are things that are problematic in the US, but they're far more problematic in much of Western Europe, where politics is seen as a craft, as something that you need to do, where people like stability. They don't like real shocks. And so one of the Trump effects could be actually a Trump boomerang. If Trump is perceived, as he is perceived now for the next weeks and months, as someone who just pretty much doesn't know what he's doing and messes up everything, people are going to think about whether it's such a good idea to bring in a new force of the radical right who shakes up things, because maybe they shake a bit too much. And so what I would think is that the Netherlands is still going down because the effect isn't big enough. But I would imagine that by September, we're talking about a very different narrative, a narrative about should we have someone who messes everything up or should we have someone competent who keeps it a bit going? Thank you very much.
That was Kaas Mudde speaking on the question, has the refugee crisis created a perfect storm for the far right? His talk was part of the 2017 Camden Conference, focusing on refugees and global migration. More information and video of his talk is available on the Camden Conference website, camdenconference.org. Our next speaker today is Maha Yahya, director of the Carnegie Middle East Center, where her work focuses broadly on political violence and identity politics, the challenges of citizenship, pluralism and social justice after the Arab uprisings, and the political and socioeconomic implications of the migration-refugee crisis. Prior to joining Carnegie, Dr. Yahya led work on participatory development and social justice at the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia, advising on social and urban policies and spearheading initiatives to address the challenges of democratic transitions in the Arab world. She's been a consultant for international organizations and the private sector on projects related to socioeconomic policy analysis, development policies, cultural heritage, poverty reduction, housing and community development, and post-conflict reconstruction in various countries, including Lebanon, Pakistan, Oman, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. Her talk is called Refugees and the Remaking of an Arab Order.
The Arab world, as you all know, is going perhaps through one of its most transformative periods since the establishment of nation states at the end of World War I. In no small part, this transformation is caused by the violent conflicts that have erupted across the region, particularly post 2011, the post-Arab uprisings that began in December 2010 in Tunisia and went on. This particular moment of hope and the pushback that it endured by governments that were seeking to hold on to power. Today, we have at least eight Arab states that are witnessing one form of conflict or the other. Citizens of Arab countries make up 5% of the world's population, just a few figures to give things and put things in perspective. And yet they account for more than 50% of the global refugee population. There are 147 million Arabs in countries experiencing war or occupation. And 17 million people have been displaced, forcibly displaced, and uprooted from their homes. Just to give further figures, 5 million of those are Palestinians who've been uprooted for the past 50 and 70 years. Today, February 2017, 4.9 million Syrian refugees and 6.3 million IDPs within Syria. In Iraq, there are 3.1 million people who have been displaced. A fraction of those were displaced after the Second Gulf War in 2003 and then the Civil War in 2006 and 2007. But the majority were displaced when ISIS took over, the so-called Islamic State took over large parts of Iraq. And now there's been additional displacement with the offensive to retake parts of Iraq by the government. Forgive me if I'm getting a bit too much detail, but In Libya, there are about 500,000 people of concern. In Yemen, a place that we rarely talk about, there are 3.1 million people who have been displaced, and we'll see some of the figures shortly. Sudan, another 3.1 million IDPs. What this means effectively for the region is, yes, there's widespread vulnerability. Just the sheer number of people who are today living below the poverty line is mind-boggling. Looking at Syria, for example, 80% of the population of Syria that still is within Syria is now living below the poverty line. 71% of those who took refuge in Lebanon are living below the poverty line, and two-thirds of those who took refuge in Jordan are also living below the poverty line. There's also food insecurity, and I'm just using those two indicators, but there are many more. 17.1 million Yemenis are food insecure. 3 million of them are severely, 7 million of them are severely food insecure. And there was an increase of 3 million in just 7 months. This is, we're talking about Yemen, which is one of the poorest countries in the world. In Iraq also, there are about 4 million people who are looking, who need assistance. In addition to this, in 2016, 1 million Syrians lived under siege in different parts of Syria. Some of these sieges have been lifted, but many still continue. The majority of those sieges were by the government of Syria itself and its allied forces, 85%, and the rest were a mixture of government, ISIS, and other armed groups. The problem with the sieges is also that they have been used as part of the bargaining chips between government militias, between the government forces and the rebel forces. In ceasefires, in negotiations, for example, when Aleppo, when the government took over the eastern parts of Aleppo this summer, the ceasefire that was announced was halted the day that it was supposed to be implemented, because the government came back and said no, in exchange for lifting the siege on Aleppo and allowing civilians to leave, we want you to lift the siege on two other villages that the rebels were controlling. So the idea that populations have become bargaining chips in a vicious proxy and civil conflict in Syria is going to have long-lasting repercussions. Now, this has also had a ripple effect on surrounding countries and on host countries. To just give a sense, in Lebanon, there are 1 million Syrian refugees approximately in a country of 4.2 million. The total population of the country is 4.2 million. So one in five people in Lebanon is a refugee, is a Syrian refugee. While the arrival of refugees is not itself the cause of problems, but they have exacerbated, the presence of an additional 1 million people in the country has exacerbated pre-existing structural challenges that the country was already facing in infrastructure and other areas, economic growth, employment, and so on and so forth. The World Bank estimates that 200,000 additional Lebanese have fallen below the poverty line, and that one-third of Lebanese youth have become unemployed, a 50% increase since 2011. Unemployments in Jordan have also increased to 21%, and then the same in the Kurdistan region, in Iraq. And I'm using, again, random figures from different places just to give a taste of what the crisis has meant for countries that are hosting the refugees. In Jordan, there are about 700,000 refugees by UN figures. In Kurdistan, the refugee inflow is not just Syrian, but also people who have been displaced by the atrocities of ISIS. Yazidis who were hunted down and killed, Christians who were hunted down and expelled, Turkmens, and so on and so forth. What we're also witnessing today is what many people have called the lost generation. There are huge numbers of children who are out of school. For example, 2.8 million UNICEF estimates of Syrian children are out of school. And 50% of those in primary school education are actually in school in a place like Lebanon. The concern also is not to go a bit beyond the figures, but actually to look at what these children are learning. In a place like Lebanon that is taking, has taken in 200,000 of 400,000 primary school, primary age children, we are not sure about what quality of education they're getting in school and what happens when they get out of school. They live in a situation where, in a context where they're not allowed to work. The government of Lebanon's policies towards refugees has been ad hoc at best, but one defining element has been they've looked at refugees from a security perspective. If you travel around the country, you will see a lot of banners where that municipalities have put up creating there's a curfew on refugees moving around in cities and towns after 7 p.m., 8 p.m. They're lovely banners. They call on their brothers and sisters of the Syrian community to simply not leave their homes after a certain hour. So the idea that they are living in a very incredibly strenuous context, and yet they see no options for the future. What is also of concern are children who are above age 12, between 12 and 18 or 12 and 25. These are the kids who are not going to school. These are kids who are severely, many of them are severely traumatized. They're incredibly vulnerable. They've witnessed things that no child should ever see. And yet, again, they are not in schools. They have nothing to fill their days, and they have very little hope in terms of what it is they can do with their future. The quote I use, I sort of put up here, was captured by a journalist who was interviewing some children in the Za'atari camp in Jordan. And I can speak a little bit about the conditions in Jordan and in Lebanon later in the question and answer period. But when she asked him, "What is your dream?" And his response was, "I think we will not get freedom. Bashar will win," i.e. Bashar al-Assad. He continued, my dream is that we will win, but my second dream is that when I turn 16 or 18, I will go to Syria and join the jihad. For him, joining the jihad is simply about fighting back against a government that has stripped him of everything, that has barrel-bombed his own population, and that has stripped him of so much. Just so as not to be very morbid, this is an image of some of those children in a camp that takes place every summer. I mean, civil society has been incredibly active over the past few years in terms of helping support with informal education. There are lots, large, incredible stories happening on the ground of people who have really stepped up to try and fill the void that is left by governments, or in places where the UN has not been able to do as much as it can because of lack of funding or other resources. This was a camp last summer where children were being taught throughout the day basic skills such as how to write in Arabic and English. And the joy these children took in this education was just remarkable. At the end of the summer, I was asking one of them what she felt, and she said, "I don't know what to do with my days now." This was an 8-year-old. "I have to go back home, and I have nothing to go back home to." This is happening in a context where there is a militarization of society. If we look at a place like Iraq or Syria, for example, there's a plethora of paramilitary groups that have emerged across both countries. I'll take Iraq as one example. There are about 50 to 60 groups operating under something called the Hashd al-Shaabi, which is a paramilitary group affiliated with government forces. The problem with this group is that while they operate under one umbrella, each of those groups sort of follows different political leaders. What's even more problematic is many of them have been constituted on ethnic and sectarian lines. The challenge is that for many communities, and I'll take the Yazidi community that I've been doing some research with recently, many of the Yazidis have refused to go back home, even from areas that have been recaptured from ISIS that are now under government control, because they do not trust that the government will protect them. They do not trust that if they go home, they will be safe. So they've preferred to stay in the miserable camp, where at least they feel that they are protected in number and that ISIS cannot come anywhere near them. They also are very worried because many of them believe that it was their neighbors that attacked them. So I think there's a lot that needs to be done in a context where there is this level of militarization. There's a lot of concern that in the post-ISIS, for example, Iraq, the problems will not be between the big sectarian blocs, between the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Kurds, but they will actually be within each group. Today you have different paramilitary groups that are Yazidis, different paramilitary groups that are Turkmen. I mean, within the same ethnic group, you'll have multiple groups. So there's a lot of concern that this could devolve even further. In Syria, what is also disconcerting, what I mentioned earlier, which is that population transfers on the basis of ethnic and sectarian identity is also taking place as part of local ceasefires in Syria. This is incredibly dangerous and sets up the, I mean, it's planting the seed for continued social strife down the road. I think that at least at the global level, there definitely was a failure in the responsibility to protect citizens who were being attacked in multiple levels. The countries in the region definitely do not have the capacity to address the fallout of the crisis. I mean, Syria is the epicenter of the refugee crisis today, globally, unfortunately. Even countries in the region are themselves involved in some of the proxy wars taking part in Syria today. More critically, I think there's also a collective responsibility to address the fallout of the conflicts, not only on moral grounds, but also as a question of common interest. And I believe Kelly will be talking probably about this in much more detail tomorrow. In today's world, the fallout from this crisis, this spread, this increase in vulnerability, in poverty, the militarization of society, the kind of trauma and injury that has befallen entire societies is not one that will remain restricted to a region or to a geography. The anger and increasing sense of marginalization across the region is quite palpable and will only increase as the assault on the liberal order and values of open borders and open societies increases, continues with the current administration, but with as we heard a little earlier, also in different parts in Europe. For people in the region, authoritarianism is really the biggest challenge. They want what everybody else wants. And it's ironic that this kind of shutdown is happening in the US and in other places at a time when people in the region rose to say, we want our freedom, we want democracy, and we want policy. At Carnegie, we did a very sort of a survey with about 110 experts, policymakers, civil society activists from across the region, different gender, political backgrounds, religious backgrounds, I mean, you name it. And one of the questions we asked, how do you rank? What are the most serious issues that the region is facing? And the number one issue that everybody pointed to was the question of governance, and then number two was the question of corruption. It was authoritarianism and then corruption. The post-conflict settlements, the post-conflict challenges, I mean, where do we go next after all of this? There is a traumatized population. There's a loss of social cohesion in the region. There's an increase in the number of female-headed households. And maybe I should just mention a silver lining in some of this. And this is not particular to Syria, but women have become empowered in exile. I've been speaking to quite a few female refugees, and the story we keep hearing is now the men have to follow us because we're the ones who are working, and the men are having to sit at home. So it's the only silver lining I could find. One young lady was recounting to me how her father, who's a general in the army, and was a general in the Syrian army, and defected when the uprising started. They now live in Jordan. And after a lot of back and forth, he eventually had to give in and allow his daughter to work. And she was talking to me about the complete transformation in dynamics within the household, where now she's the one earning money and he's sitting at home doing nothing. And it's earned her a lot of respect in the eyes of her father, but also in the eyes of her brothers and sort of the surrounding environment. I think first and foremost, if we want to talk about where do we want to go next, there is a need for a just political settlement. There's a lot of discussion of a political settlement in Syria. Most recently, Stefan de Mistura, the special envoy, has been talking about a political settlement, and they're no longer talking about a political transition. There's a lot of concern with this among Syrian refugee communities. We're doing a project right now where we're working with Syrian refugees to find out and to talk to them about the triggers of return. What would they want to see, and how do they think about when they talk about returning to Syria? And a lot of what they're concerned about, I mean, the need for just political settlement is that international experience shows that if communities are not involved in this settlement, the war will erupt again, basically, in short. What do refugees effectively want? One of the things that they want, we always have a bias for repatriation, and we focus a lot of our work on repatriation. And 9 times out of 10, the refugees do want to go back home. Most of the Syrian refugees we've been talking to want to go back home, but they will only consider going back home under very special circumstances. The first thing they demand is security. They want to know that if they go back home, they will be secure, their children will be secure, their families will be secure. However, they don't trust the government, even when they are pro-regime. They do not trust the government nor any of the opposition forces to provide that security. There's a complete loss of confidence in the law and in the current system within the country. So the only thing they've come up with is we need international guarantees, and international guarantees in the form of boots on the ground. They want to see people, actually physically people there, guaranteeing their safety in Syria. They want an end to conscription. One of the big challenges in Syria, again, and I should say this project is with mainly Syrian refugees, is that a lot of young men have had to flee Syria because the age of conscription was raised to age 50. So that's how desperate the regime has become to recruit people, unfortunately. So a lot of young men who do not want to take part in the conflict, who see no reason why they should be killing each other, have had to flee. A lot of families have fled because they have young boys who would be conscripted if they stayed. So that's another thing that people are very keen on. They want to see an end to conscription into the army. They're all seeking a transitional government, repeatedly, whether it's in Jordan or in Lebanon, where we've had these discussions so far. The focus always is on a transitional government, whether they're pro-regime or pro-rebels, and the level of openness about this varies from context to context. They want to see a transitional governance, a government system. They're very worried about the level of sectarian discord in the country. They're very worried about the level of international interference in their country, and here it's a bit of a conundrum because they don't want the current actors who are in, i.e. they don't want the Russians, they don't want the Iranians, they don't want the Saudis, but they want to see an international force that they can trust that can sort of guarantee whatever peace agreement is reached. They also want to see a form of justice. When we ask them, and this is one of the things we talk to them about, the potential of for amnesty. Would you be willing to go back if there is complete amnesty and absolute amnesty? And resoundingly, consistently, it's no. We cannot live with people we can understand that there could be amnesty for some, but we have to be very careful about what kind of amnesty there is. People who have committed atrocities will commit them again and again if there isn't some sort of a transitional justice mechanism in place. They're not seeking vengeance, but they're worried. They're worried about the future of their families. Surprisingly, last on their list is livelihoods. I mean, of course, education and health they want to see, especially those who have children. They want to know that their children will be getting education. But repeatedly, they would go back and say, I will go back to Syria and I can find work. I'm not worried about this. I want to see everything else there first before I will consider going back to Syria. So I think there is a need for some creative thinking, and many, many in this room have already been doing this in terms of how to address this fallout, how does one rethink the responsibility to protect, how do we go beyond humanitarian support to support these refugees in building their lives in a situation where at least to my mind, based on everything we've seen so far, people are not going to be going back anytime soon. How do we involve communities in this process? And perhaps this is the most fundamental issue, is really how do we involve these communities that everybody is talking on their behalf, but nobody's actually talking to them to see what it is that they need and what they want. There is definitely a collective responsibility to deal with this crisis. I wanted to just end this to remind everybody why this uprising started in Syria in particular. This was when Robin Williams, this is a town called Farnabil. They became very famous in the last 6 years for their fantastic banners and posters. I have plenty more I can show you in the break. But this one was about freedom. That sort of captured for them. It's a quote from Robin Williams. To be free, such a thing would be greater than all the magic and all the treasures in all the world. This is what they were looking for. This is what they are still looking for. So let's keep that in mind. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. This week, we are featuring talks from the 2017 Camden Conference on Refugees and Global Migration, Humanity's Crisis, featuring speakers exploring the varied causes of the current international migration crisis and the challenges that come with accepting immigrants from particular countries, regions, and demographic groups. All of the 2017 Camden's conference talks and panel discussions are archived on their website, camdenconference.org. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast at mainepublic.org. Charles Beck is the executive producer. For Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.